Dr. Greg Casey joins me this week to discuss the history of German adjunct lagers. This is Beersmith Podcast number 288.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 288, and it's early September 2023. Dr. Greg Casey joins me this week to discuss the history of German adjunct lagers. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the American Homebrewers Association. The Homebrewers Association invites you to choose your own brew venture. Join for one year and select a free brewing book for more than 60 titles to match your fermentation goals. Visit homebrewersassociation.org/beersmith to join the American Homebrewers Association and treat yourself to a new brewing book. Again, that special link is homebrewersassociation.org/beersmith. And Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith Brewing Software. Beersmith for the Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to the same full suite of recipes as your desktop version. Try Beersmith Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to click that like and subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're listening to. Clicking these buttons is a great way to support the show. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Dr. Greg Casey. Greg has an extensive history in brewing, including Carling O'Keefe, Molson's, Carlsberg, Anheuser-Busch, Stroh's, Coors, Molson Coors, and Miller Coors. He holds a PhD in applied microbiology and food science and was the 2001-2002 chair of the Education Committee of the Master Brewers Association. He was also president of the American Society of Brewing Chemists from 2005 to 2006. And it's great to have him back. How you doing, Greg?
Hey, thanks for having me back, Brad. Doing great. Thank you again for having me back.
It's a pleasure. We had you on just a couple months ago, but last time you were talking about yeast, which was a lot of fun. Because I really didn't know much about, particularly the yeast that the big brewers use. So that was a good episode. Mm-hmm. But this week you wanted to visit your 5-volume set that you've been working on. And if I remember right, I think it started out as a 3-volume set, right?
It did start as 9, and then John Palmer, the editor, said, no way from the MBA.
9? Okay.
9. He said, he's not going to live long enough, and he probably wouldn't want to edit 9. So we got it down to 3.
Oh, great.
A year and a half ago, but then we expanded to 5, and that's locked in now.
Yeah, I was looking at my notes from a couple episodes ago, and I think you had 3 at the time. Anyways, it's called The Inspiring History and Legacies of American Lager Beer. Mm-hmm. Let's start with, where are you right now with the 5-volume set?
Well, you know, if you let me, Brad, I'd like to use a new product development for the series. If you view it as a product, you know, what was the process that got us here? Or concept in terms of coming up with the idea for it took place probably 2007. Much of my career was involved in quality assurance. And I remember trying to find, you know, with a pissed off, can I say that? Plant manager with us.
I think it's okay. It's a clean show, but you know.
Clean show. Okay. You know, I was researching, was there anything more definitive for caustic contamination? Because every brewer's got to be sensitive about it, right? You know, sodium residues. And it's all based on, at least then, process capability surveys. And that's kind of indirect, even though it is helpful. But I was trying to find, you know, more technical methods that are more direct. And I didn't find one. But in the course of that, I came across a reference called the 1890 Turner Adulteration Bill. And it just blew me away when I read it, because it was all about essentially making American brewing German brewing, all malt, right? So the concept took about, I don't know, two minutes. The feasibility was the next time I sat down with Bill Coors. I said, Bill, are you aware of any of this, you know, history, the American history regarding the controversy or standards of American lager. And he said no. So that was feasibility, and that took another week. And then the last 16 years has been the development, 16 years. The last 10 on a full-time basis, 60 to 80 hours a week. Wow. And I'm looking at everything, Library of Congress hearings, newspapers.com, digital libraries, brewing journals, you name it. And it's closing in now on 20,000 primary period references, every one of them printed, documented downstairs in the basement, to my wife's chagrin. So the first two are going to be coming out of that. And can I prompt you for the
first two volumes, right? Correct?
Yeah, first two volumes. Yeah. Yeah. And that first image, if I was this image here, I know it's difficult to see, but when we were in Portugal last fall, this was a brewing museum in the main square there in Lisbon. And if you could look at it, it has a flag, although you can't see it on each individual glass, of every country that essentially consumes beer on a major part of the market in the world. And you can see it's all filled with one type of beer, which may not be representative, say, of Belgium or
lager.
But anyhow, I saw that as a perfect imagery of, well, what the heck, you know, came out of America from the 1850s, but more so the 1870s and 1920s that went on to influence the global picture. And it's pretty much our heritage that in terms of coming up with a chill-proof lager beer that stayed clear when ice cold, that's us. And that's what you get around the world. So that was that. Let's go to the second slide there.
Yep.
So these are the first two volumes, and you see on the left, the first volume is essentially an overview of what the next four are going to present as the history. And it's volume one, and it looks at the period, the last decade, the 1940s, that I cover in the book, in the series. And it's about the, you know, the beer, our beer, Adjunct Lager beer, the beer of myths and legacies denied. And it, you know, kind of not an argument you'd expect to hear for something as lowly as Adjunct Lager beer, right? But I've grown to develop tremendous respect and appreciation for their guts and the heritage and their legacies. The one on the right, then the second volume, and these will be concurrent, Brad. They'll both come up this fall.
Oh, awesome.
This is the beer of war and global famine relief. And it covers the period, and essentially from particularly 1943, 1948, when we were at war, but also after the war, when supply chains were all blown to hell and corn and rice were foods to prevent a global famine. It was the most difficult time to get adjuncts in the United States. It's sort of 180 from the, corn and rice started being used, you know, because of the war, malt was shut. No. Malt was never, I think it was like 99% of 1942 levels all the way through the war. But there were times breweries shut down in summer of 43 because they couldn't get corn. They shut down around making all malt beer.
Really? They had to have the adjuncts, huh?
Yeah, they had the adjuncts. So the corn and rice had been traditional since the 1870s and by 1940s. So we were using raw barley, cassava, sorghum, potatoes. I mean, in huge quantities, all recorded in the government statistics. So that kind of takes a look at that unique history of that period, which is one of the most unique periods of American brewing. So I'm excited by that one.
So it's interesting. Both volumes cover a fairly short amount of time, 1941 to 1948, huh?
They do. And because it, you know, 1933 was repealed. So I do talk a little bit about that period between the two. I say between the two sevens, April 7th, when Roosevelt said, okay, beer's legal again, and December 7th. 1941, of course, Pearl Harbor. But during that period, I had my paradigm. Again, I'm not born American, but I had assumed when 1933 came, beer would have been going through the roof, right? Everybody,
You would think so.
And they did for a few years, but then it was in a decline, a significant decline from about 37 to 41. And the war saw, particularly in those years from 43 to 48, an explosive growth in volume.
I guess that's not that surprising, right?
And it was a lighter beer. It was the lightest beer, particularly in 46, 47. Those are the lightest beers we made in terms of adjunct ratios up until the 1970s with the release of the Modern Light Lager. So there was a lesson there. The brewers had forgotten a lesson from the 19th century, came back, brewers being brewers, they're going to make what they want, right? Yeah. And then the war forced. It wasn't, you know, deliberate. It was like, okay, we're going to meet the volume. This is what we do. So it was a significant period of growth, but also of learnings that have been applied in the lager industry. And I talk a bit in the second volume about so many of the similarities between the craft revolution from the 1980s to today in terms of what that first half century was like in the adjunct lager revolution. But that's the subject of another day.
Well, before we leave the first two volumes behind, which we did cover a little bit last time, can you tell us when they're coming out exactly and where people can buy them?
Personally, I don't have an exact date. I am okay. September 14th. I'm getting the, they call it the hard pass. They don't call them galleys. I've been chastised for using that word. I'm new to this, right? I would expect by the end of this month, we'll have a firm publishing date. But at this, you know, this hard pass, my job's done. Yeah, and basically it's at the MBAA taking these and coming up with a schedule for publishing. So,
and when would you buy them from the MBAA? Would it be available like on Amazon, that kind of thing?
I know it would be through the web through the MBA Master Brewers Association website. Yep.
Cool. Well, let's go on to the next one. While your series focuses on American lager, you did end up diving into German beer history, particularly German lager history. What makes German lager history so important?
Well, you know, ignorance is bliss, I guess, because I didn't, you know, again, being Canadian by birth, I really didn't know the history of adjunct lager beer in the United States. And when I got into this period, the last 16 years, it was really early on pretty apparent that you can't follow our history or describe our history or understand, know it, why it developed the way it did, without knowing Germany's, because the two were so interconnected on each other. And if I could get a slide up here, the sure. first one there. Sure. You see that, you know, back up top there, Ludwig Heger. And again, apologies in advance to any German listeners, because I know I'm not enunciating, pronouncing things correctly. But in, you know, July 1862, Ludwig Heger, Altenburg, Germany, got a U.S. patent, improvement in brewing when Indian corn was used. And one of the, he spent from December 1862 to November 1863, right in the height of the Civil War, right? And he came over here to do test brews. This is really exciting because I've never seen this reported before when the first adjunct lagers were brewed in the United States. Mm-hmm. He came over and 4 years later, he wrote a extensive book of his travels talking about where he did test brews, pilot brews of adjunct lager beer and like the Biegen Brewery and Dobbs Ferry, Windisch and Mulhauser in Cincinnati, the Christian Moorline Brewery in Cincinnati. He was in Kentucky. He was down, you know, in New Orleans.
Wow. And when was this, I guess?
That was between December 1862 and November 1863. So to me, I mean, he names breweries. He names, he describes stories when he got run out of Indianapolis at a brewery there when the locals got wind they were going to make a rice lager beer. So he said he had to get out of Dodge essentially because it hadn't been, you know, this is 1863, I'm sure. And, you know, it wasn't widely accepted, even though, as this third book will survive me do, they were brewing rice beer in Germany in the 1860s, 1870s kind of deal. So it had passed that threshold. But, so it's a fascinating, the genesis, that's the earliest I could find. And it's considerably earlier than, say, Anton Schwartz's history of the influence. But next image, I think, is also sure. helpful.
Yep.
Yeah, when I was talking about, The double mash system. This is beautiful. And Nicholas Baumann.
So this is just describe the image for folks that aren't.
Thank you very much. Yeah. It's an image that shows a double mash system, and which is the American system. And this was a a Bavarian trained brewer who set up shop in Kalamazoo, Michigan, of all places. No disrespect to Kalamazoo, but it was about the use of Indian corn in the double mash system. That's 1868, I think. You know,
so describe the double mash system to us as well.
Well, the double mash system is to how do you deal with this is before. The explosion of corn syrups, you had to be able to use the adjuncts in the brew house to get them converted. So you had, and this image shows which evolved to be a cooker where a portion of the malt was mixed with the corn grits in this particular pattern, gelatinized and put back to the main mash. So those two decoction, you take a bit of the whole thing, boil it. But, by the 10, 20 years after this, the second was exclusively cookers if they didn't use pre-gelatinized or syrups.
So they're actually cooking the corn to gelatinize it as opposed to some kind of cereal mash on it then.
Yeah, right? In the 1860s, they hadn't gotten to, like the equivalent of cornflakes, for example, the pre-gelatinized or the syrups. But in the 1860s, it was still... it started as grits, and grits came with their own problems, right, with oils and things like that. So very quickly, by the 1870s, that had been dropped as a form of adjunct of corn.
And very rice. Cool.
Back to that image. Next one, please.
Yep.
And this one, you can't see it, but it's what it says. This is an article from the 1881 New York Times, and it's about how lager beers are made. And it was a controversial decade in the United States. This is New York Times. And I put,
this is 1881, title, it says.
Right? 1881, yeah. And it describes, the use of cornmeal, the use of cornstarch, rice, grape sugar, which, by the way, was, there was glucose and grape sugar. Grape sugar was powdered glucose extracted from corn after it had been hydrolyzed to yield glucose.
And that's pretty wild. Grape sugar made from corn, huh? Is that it?
Yeah. Well, back then, there was corn and rice, I think, fairly equally. But the reason for this one, and people can't see it, but if you get a chance on YouTube, virtually every name on that list of brewers, I called the American Beer Manifesto, they're all Germans. And I've gone in, and part of the 16 years, I've gone in each one of these individuals, MyHeritage and Ancestry.com and other sources. Where did their journey start as Americans? How did they get here? And in this time, most of them weren't even citizens yet.
It's interesting. I just noticed the Yingling brothers around there. So.
Oh, yeah. There's one of the Yingling. He set up a lager brewery in New York City. And he was one of, and apparently he was a rogue son. Something. You come across some family history that could be interesting. You start digging. But he was a bit of a rogue in New York. He did build a very nice lager brewery and adjunct lager. But he fell in the, anyhow, let's just leave family history as family history.
By 1881, clearly adjunct lager had taken off, right?
Oh yeah, it really had. I mean, it really, the 1870s, the last ones, the German, Austrian, Hungarian, these Germans here in New York City, Staten Island, Brooklyn, everywhere you see there. I mean, they had started to run with this style. Yeah, it had already, by the early 1880s, as a category, become the single largest in the United States by far. By the 1890s, it was like nearly 90% of the market.
So, I mean, that's pretty amazing. In a period of, less than 20 years, it pretty much dominated the market.
Yeah, and we'll conclude this session with a slide that shows that very directly.
Okay. Do you want to go into that then?
No, let's just go to the next slide, I think. Yeah.
Okay. I'll leave it. Go ahead.
Now, this one here. What in the heck is a pitcher? We're going now switching over to Germany, right?
Yeah.
And I love history. I've always loved European history. And I remember as a young, I think it was like 16 or 17, learning Germany, because my parents' generation, Second World War, right, had fought. I'd always assumed Germany was Germany, had been for a long time. Ignorance. And the German Empire was only really created, the predecessor to the Third Reich and the predecessor, you know, to remove from the current democratic, the Germany. That picture there shows it was, and little did I know, because when I was an 18-year-old, I was standing right there back in 1974. That picture shows two events that really profoundly impact the Rhein-Heinz-Gebot conversation.
Okay, go ahead.
Kind of right. The guy in the white there, that's Count Bismarck. He's sort of the Machiavelli of Germany. He was the head honch from Prussia. The guy standing up is the first Kaiser. And on that day, in January 1871, two things happened. The German Empire was created, and the Kaiser was installed as its first, the Count Wilhelm was his first Kaiser. You fast forward, this guy in the white, in April 1872, he opens the Reichstag building in Berlin, famous building, right?
Yep.
And it's a new empire. The Reichstag was just commissioned. And in his very first paragraph in his speech to the assembled representatives in the Reichstag, he talks of the need to tax malt substitutes.
Interesting.
I mean, I read this, I went, what? And he was very explicit about that, because until that point in time, only malt had been taxed, right, as a brewing material. Any brewer, and there are a lot of them, using rice or sugars or syrups, from particularly the latter two, from beets or potatoes, as extract, it wasn't taxed. And what does an empire need, especially in the 1870s, when it's competing with France, Britain, Russia, and a nascent United States, soon to, you know, three, 4 decades after that? But it needs money. And they set up their taxation laws based on a finite number of buckets that would generate revenue for the empire. And if, next slide, please.
Yep.
After this one.
Oops.
Sorry. Oh, Freddie Mercury's.
We'll get in a second here. Yeah, little pop up there.
Okay, no problem.
Okay.
Yeah, this one here. Again, you can't, for the audience, basically,
a big table.
If the German Reichstag and Treasury was going to collect taxes, they kept great records, right? And I, you know, for every year from 1872, when Bismarck said this is how it's going to be, this one shows, you can't really see it, but it shows, it describes every bucket. So barley malt, of course, rice, all kinds of sugars, all kinds of syrups. I mean, it just puts them in by category. It gives you a sense of the ratio of malt to adjuncts for every single year. And I got those for every single year, right?
Well, I mean, what we can see is there's clearly a lot of adjuncts being used in the chart, right?
Not as much as the United States. We'll get into that a little bit later. But, you know, depending upon, because it was something like 26 different duchies, kingdoms, states, you name it. I mean, that coalition that became the empire, Bavaria down the south, was just one of them, all malt. But everywhere else, they had their own, you know, their own laws. And so the empire had to standardize it. That's why they couldn't just do malt. Would have been fine if Bavaria was all of Germany, but it wasn't. Everywhere else, particularly Prussia and the northern German areas, and other areas as well, about Rhineland-Palatinate, you know, in terms of rice.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we tend to focus on the Bavarian purity law, you know, the Rhein-Heinz-Gebot, but Germany actually had a long history of brewing outside of that, right?
Yeah, the earliest, and again, you know, my intent was to study the United States, but it's very clear that, you know, by the 1850s, and not just Germany, and it wasn't Germany in the 1850s, right, as I'm learning, it was something else.
Yeah.
What part of it was in. But, you know, also in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, in terms of the use, you know, Bolling. Everybody knows Bolling. Dury's Bolling, right? Well, read his papers on the use of potato starch as an adjunct. And he was very glowing of the use of this adjunct to brew lager beer, as was Anton Ludwig Haker 10 years later in terms of coming over to America with corn. So there was a considerable, it was Central Europe, I would say, and parts of Germany for sure, that they were using adjuncts easily the early 1850s, maybe late 1840s. And it's interesting because it costs more, you know, it costs more in those early decades for the rice beer in particular to for the consumer to brew it and for the to buy it and the consumer and the brewer to brew it, as it was in the United States. Consumers paid a brewers charged a dollar more, which is a big chunk back in 1870s and early 1880s, for adjunct lager beer brewed with rice. That changed with the advent of technology and new types of sources, but at its genesis, both in Germany, it cost a certain number of pfennigs more to buy it at their beer stube, I guess. So it's a fascinating history.
Do you think the adjunct lager predated the all malt lager or not?
In the United States?
I was thinking more in Europe, actually.
No, absolutely. The all malt was king for many, many centuries, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, from that period between St. Michael's Day, whatever it is, between September and the spring, we can only brew in the winter months, 1523.
Yeah.
So at least 3.5 centuries, all malt, particularly because it was southern Germany, Bavaria was where the lager was. Northern Germany had all these top fermented styles of beer. The history of using adjuncts there goes back earlier, but they were even having many of the Belgian style beers that we associate with Belgium, but there were parts of Northern Germany where just as portfolio styles was just as vibrant. Lager didn't really become a generic German, if you will, until after the Pilsner Revolution and Helles, and they realized this style is killing it. We better start brewing it.
Well, you mentioned before the podcast that you're focused on the period kind of 1850 to 1920 with this work, which is really when the continental lagers started to grow rapidly in the U.S. and particularly adjunct lagers. But why is this period important, really, across the board for the development of American beers?
Yeah, because that's when it happened. I mean, we were pre-1850s beer as a category. It was just a pimple on a butt of an elephant. I mean, it wasn't much. I mean, we were hard liquor, ciders, but we were drinking everything but beer by and large. I mean, yeah, ales, porters, and IPAs and all that. But as a percentage of the market, it was pretty small. And then when the Germans came over, the Russian Revolution, when they didn't get democracy in 1848, you read this so many times in their biographies. They came over here to be free. They came over here to do what they felt was the best for their family, to provide for their family. These guys got it in terms of pursuit of liberty and living the dream, right? And they lived it to the fullest. And they started brewing all malt lager. This was about the earliest. I have found it, I think 1842 is most commonly referred to in online sites, which because online must be true.
Yeah, everything's true. Everything I read online is true.
I've got it back to the late 1830s in terms of brewing lager beer. And that was a Dunkel. That was basically a Dunkel all malt Bavarian brown, right? That was pretty much American lager beer from late 1830s, 1840s, 1850s. It's only when you start getting into the late 1860s and early 1870s that lager beer that's brewed using adjuncts, typically about 30% adjuncts, that's when it starts to take off. And that's when it became the beer of when the German-American brewers, when they're testifying in front of then-Senator McKinley about why do you use rice and corn to brew beer, because they point and say, we brew it for you Americans. It became the beer of the United States. And I'll get into a little bit of that later. But that's, it really took off. It just took off. It became our national beverage. You see reference to it as national beverage. You see you read anecdotal stories about, a reporter for the New York Times saying when he trailed the Union Army during the war, there were empty bottles of whiskey that said, yeah, we had passed through here. He said, but when he was in the Philippines and Puerto Rico and China, the Boxer Revolution, he said they were trailed by empty bottles of beer. We'd become a beer drinking nation, and it was adjunct lager beer that fueled that phenomenal rise.
Awesome. Well, let's go back to Germany for a minute. What were some of the key milestones in Germany? You mentioned the Kaiser, obviously, and after that, but what happened after that? Because obviously at some point, Reinheitsgebot took over, right?
Let's go to the next slide. There's two really intriguing dates. This one here, it says in June 3rd, the Reinheitsgebot, I think, is commonly assumed in many ways to be Germans way of making lager beer forever, since 1500s. But that was Bavaria's. And on June 3rd, 1906, my grandfather was alive, so to me it's not that long ago, the Reichstag on June 3rd, 1906 passed a law, and it says in this title, you can get all, again, a lot of this was war booty, by the way, after digital libraries in the First World War, the Yanks came back with stuff from libraries and put it into Stanford and Harvard and all these other places. You see that stamp, boom, basically war booty. But anyhow, laws concerning the order of the Reich budget and Reich debt. And the Brewing Tax Act was passed as a means of generating revenue and changing that 1872 law that I showed you with the Kaiser.
Right, right.
This made the, for lager beer at least, this made Bavaria's way the empire's way. So all these other, only malt was taxed and allowed. Only malt, hops, water, yeast, right?
So, 1906 is basically when they nailed down Reinheitsgebot across the whole empire.
Across, exactly. Yeah. And that started then. And it blew my mind when I was reading, why was it passed? There's a lot of controversy. Why did the Bavarian Ryan High School pass 1518? It was quality, or it was the Dukes trying to save their ass from, a population that was starving. There's just a gazillion. And we'll never know. But this one, the German empires, to me, there is no doubt. When you read, and I hope that's what people see in the third volume, it was all about money. And it was specifically geared, these taxation laws and the buckets like cigarettes and, changing the beer tax law to be just malt with a massive increase. It was to raise funds for for the Kaiser's Navy. And this is 1906. Remember 1914, 18, the First World War?
Yeah, Bismarck's pretty busy at this time, if I recall.
Yeah, this extremely. And, the Prussians had a great land army. They didn't worry about that. Their Luftwaffe, the Genesis, was doing well. They didn't have a navy. And they knew to be a global superpower in 1906. And the day that, when the Reichstag was passed that June 3rd, 1906, what was in the lobby of the Reichstag?
What?
A diorama showing the naval resources ships of the British Empire, the French Empire, the Russian Empire, and America by now, right? And it was kind of like, oh, here's us here. We got to get our butts in gear to develop a navy. And they did. They started the war too soon, I guess, in World War One, to have it fully operational, because it really didn't have that much of an impact being in harbor much of the war, Jutland, of course, being the exception. But it was a fascinating, there's no doubt, and it was part of the taxation laws. I'll make the argument, and again, I just leave it to the reader to decide for themselves when they read it, when this third volume comes out next year. And that'll be the third. It was a fascinating time.
Interesting. So, so you believe it was tax driven then, huh? As opposed to, they'd like to talk now about purity laws, but.
Yeah, June 3rd, 1906 was absolute. And there's no mention when you read the, much like the Library of Congress, and we have the archives of the Senate hearings or whatever, you can read the transcripts of when they are debating the legislation. There was a hint of, Northern German brewers, but they were split in between, we want to be able to be, to use only malt like they do in Bavaria. Right. Mm-hmm. They were saying, it gives us a better competition to compete. But then you had all these, particularly, and we'll talk a bit towards the end, brewers of manufacturers of adjuncts in northern Germany, particularly the saccharin industry, which is really surprising, were lobbying hard against it, as were some other aspects or areas or parts of the brewing community in northern Germany. So it was kind of split. But from a legislative perspective, 100%. Made no bones about it. We need to get a navy.
Interesting. What's going on in the U.S. Brewing in the late 1800s now?
Oh, can we do one more?
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No problem. Let's do this one
here.
This is fascinating.
Can you describe this for the folks that are listening?
Yeah, this one here shows on the left. Everybody's heard of, if you remember, the Weimar Republic after Germany was defeated.
Oh, my goodness,
Yeah, and inflation took over, particularly 1921, 1922, or 24. So this is a slide that shows the meteoric rise of the value of one gold mark and paper marks. Remember, they were using wheelbarrows to buy a loaf of bread, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
well, it was interestingly enough. There was September 1921 right up to 1924. That law that was 1906 in terms of what they could use. Mm-hmm. Modified to allow the Weimar Republic to permit the use of rice and corn in brewing lager beer for domestic consumption.
Yeah, and I like the title there. It says Germany opened to fake beer is what. Yeah, they're talking about using adjuncts, I guess.
Yeah, these are pulled from 1921. So on the right, it says, yeah, the Reichstag overrules Bavarian protest against adulteration of drink. Corn in their beer. Rice will also be used. Reichstag votes for pure beer. That was a three-year period. And ironically, because, this was 1921, 24. Who wasn't brewing adjunct lager beer? Us. You know, the prohibition was already kicking in.
That's true.
In Germany, this three-year window, they were using adjuncts at the same ratio, essentially, much higher than they had in the pre-1906, because Weimar Republic, in terms of, how to do it more cost-effectively, I guess. But when you look at the Reichstag statistics, and again, they're there every year, this is how much they use the semolina or corn and rice. It's a fascinating three-year window that I know. My father was alive when that started, when that was going on. So I'm like, this is, at least to me, not ancient history. So it's a fascinating, these are the kind of things that readers, I hope, will find beyond interesting, but profoundly challenging.
And perhaps. Of course, it was a horrible time in the Weimar Republic. You could literally start drinking your beer, and by the time you finished your beer, the price would be up, right?
Well said. Exactly.
Basically how fast inflation was rising.
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's switch back to U.S. for a minute and talk a little bit about, back it up just a little. We'll go talk a little bit about what's going on in U.S. brewing in the late 1800s as we, this is before the First World War and so on, before Prohibition, obviously.
Yeah. Let's get the 10th slide here.
Got it.
It's the last one. Okay. This slide shows, for the readers who can't see it, but it shows the period between 1880 and 1915. Mm-hmm. In terms of domestic production of beer in different parts of the world. And you see the United States started in 1880. Our production, annual production, was down there with Belgium and France and Russia. And, it was not a big deal and barely above Austria. But then you see this line, it goes from lower left to top right, a straight line up, right? We became, United States of America, 1910, 1911, became the leading producer of beer in the world. And we'd been in the boonies on a global basis during that, when it started, as recently as the late, 1880. And it was fueled exclusively by adjunct lager beer, our national beverage. So that's the beer that drove the rise. And what you listeners can't see on this graph is, remember 1906 again, Germany?
Yeah.
You see they called it Bierkriegs. The consumers protested because it wasn't something that was done to make.
Yeah, German. There's a little drop there in 1906.
All the costs got passed on the consumers. So you got these fascinating articles about beer kriegs, beer wars, people refusing to drink lager, drink beer in Germany because of the huge increase in taxes. It doesn't fit the narrative very well of, it was welcomed with, now all beer is Bavarian. No. It was follow the money in every aspect of it.
Interesting. So U.S. explosive growth there, and pre-prohibition, I guess I wanted to ask, pre-prohibition, we didn't have a huge variety of beers, right? It was dominated by American adjunct lager, is that correct?
Yeah, that was, I would say in terms of the general public, the adjunct lager beer, certainly, within the German communities where they brewed beer, for themselves, when they said some of these areas, we brew all malt beer for ourselves. I mean, they were brewing styles of beer that are, a craft brewer today would easily recognize, things like Kolsch and other styles of lager mm-hmm. beer. They were, these were all malt beers that they were brewing for themselves, but that was a fairly tiny fraction. But that, and even that kind of petered out especially with anti-German sentiments during the First World War. I think that set back some of these more traditional all malt German styles. But yeah, it was as
I'm asking because I think a lot of us had this sort of mythical view that before Prohibition there was all these different beers available, and it was only after that we ended up with the adjunct lager. But it wasn't the case, right?
And I addressed that in that first volume, The Beer of Myths, because that's so true. You can find, you know, there were thousands of different styles of beer in the United States before Prohibition. I'm going, not really. I mean, yeah.
Mostly one. Huh?
Yeah, mostly one. Yeah, still a little bit of ales and porters in the Northeast with Massachusetts and these tiny bits. But it was essentially, and you can get, you know, the Civil War, 1862. Ever since, what funded the Union side was a tax on beer, and it was for every barrel of beer. And then part of the legislation in 1862, they had to record every ounce or every barrel of beer brewed, but also every pound of material used to brew it from 1862 on. So like the German records, we've got the American records. And when you look at the stats, say, in late 1880s, 1890, and you compare them to half a century later, the ratios of malt adjuncts are essentially the same. I mean, so it was the dominant beer fairly early during that. 1880s is when it truly exploded.
I think you mentioned this last time we talked, but there was a push to do Reinheitsgebot here in the U.S. at one time, right?
Huge push. And that's pretty much the focus of the fourth and fifth volumes. And that's where particularly inspiring. I mean, there were, you know, I mentioned the 1890, the Turner Adulteration Bill. It was a running battle for half a century, how to force these German or German-American, because some of them are still German citizens, to brew an all-malt lager beer, like the Reinheitsgebot, right? I mean, but it's important to note, it wasn't called the Reinheitsgebot here then. It wasn't even the Reinheitsgebot 1906. The first reference I could find to the term Reinheitsgebot was in 1908, when a petitioner sued the German Empire Treasury for compensation because of malt processing aid they couldn't use after the 1906 legislation, and he sued to get compensation. Hoping he would be compensated for his losses for the, you know, facility he constructed, the product he developed, and he was rejected. But interestingly, his argument in his support, he said, well, the saccharin industry in Germany, they got compensated when saccharin was banned, and it was only like as recently as 1902, for example, as a use in top fermented sweet beers or styles, particularly in Berlin and other places. So the saccharin industry won their petition and got compensated, but not him. But anyhow, so the Reinheitsgebot was, not until 1908. But so they were, they substituted the Reinheitsgebot, but they call it pure beer. So the advocates of all malt beers said pure beer. And universally, every institution of power in the United States said, this is a bad thing using corn and rice. You just can't. You got to be making all malt beer. And the Germans, again, coming back to that, well, we make it all malt. It comes back from many accounts. It's not sold. We make it for ourselves. You Americans, especially in the 1870s, 1880s, want this beer that when it is in a glass and the beer is clear when it's ice cold. And for three, four decades, only American breweries only could make an adjunct lager beer that was chill-proof. I mean, it was our contribution, but that's because of our culture. It, you know, it wasn't a reflection of costs or anything. It was delivering to the consumer the American penchant for ice cold beverages. You know, and it, we've always had. I remember when we came down to the United States in 1987. The first fridge I saw had this hole in the front of it. And you put a glass and you just put a little pressure on this thing and ice came. I'd never seen it before. Maybe because I grew up in Canada, I don't know. But, you know, it was just little things like that that helped me get at a gut level. We've always liked our beverages ice cold as well as our beer. It was no different.
Well, really quickly, I'm running low on time, but I want to talk about World War One, and of course, led eventually into Prohibition here in the U.S. What was the impact on lager beers?
You know, I'll for the United States, I'll summarize it using 2 points. First, as I mentioned earlier, there was a tremendous amount of prejudice against Germans because of the war, right? And it was not a popular time to be a German-American brewer. So that kind of hurt, as I mentioned, some of those other styles, but it also hurt the industry as a whole. But it also had an impact in terms of, it's kind of parallel with the Second World War. We brewed, do you know that Food Commissioner Hoover, future President Hoover, we brewed from beginning October 1918 for 2 months, all malt lager beer. We essentially, and it was in order for the United States to save rice and corn in anticipation of Belgian famine relief once the war ended, which it did, right? November 11th. Yeah. So we had a 2-year period, which is really cool. I didn't know that. I wasn't called to write high school, but it was just called, we got to feed the Belgians, which in 46, 47, 48, ironically, we did again. In Germany, I would say, certainly they couldn't get the materials to make beer. Right. I mean, the blockades, embargoes. But there was one little interesting legacy, July 1918, the German tax law that one I showed you from 1872. It was modified in 1908 to tax beer on volume, not malt. Why? Well, because there was only like this much malt available to make beer. It wasn't beer. They weren't getting revenue. What is
I assume just like in the UK, the alcohol percentages dropped to nothing, right?
Yeah, pretty essentially. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't have tasted like beer. I mean, it was just something. I think for the troops, they might have had, and they did brew. Interestingly, the Germans did brew adjunct lager beers in Belgium and occupied France, and the records are very clear on that for the troops. But yeah, so that was kind of a legacy. So it was a turbulent time for a lot of reasons.
Interesting. And then just a couple words about Prohibition, maybe.
Well, it really, to me, it was more than stopping, the production of beer at 3%, 4%, 5% alcohol beer. It goes beyond that because it really killed an entire industry. The suppliers, the manufacturers, the engineers, the technology. We were the Germany of today. In the five half century before going into Prohibition, it was American technology that was going around the world. Africa, mm-hmm. Australia, things to build, construct using American equipment, using American materials, and the brewing schools, all that died in those whatever number of years, 20 to 1919 to 1933. It all just died. And we never recovered relative to those aspects. But in terms of how the style is made, in terms of adjunct lager beer, whether you're in Croatia, whether you're in Greece, whether you're in Japan, China, drinking, a snow lager, those heritage and the roots are all ours.
Interesting. Very interesting. Well, I want to get your closing thoughts on the close relationship between German and U.S. lager history.
I thought for this one, to me, there's really... what really struck me in terms of the two histories, from a diversity perspective, mm-hmm. I was really, obviously in Germany and the United States at this time was all men, right? But I was astonished and pleased. And I think it's really cool part of history we need to celebrate, both in Germany and in the United States, the number of brewers who are of the Jewish faith, like a very large number. I certainly didn't expect that, shall we say, in Germany. So I think there were parallels between the two from a diversity perspective in the United States. They were Christians. They were Christians of the Catholic and Protestant faith. They were the Jewish faith. I mean, it was really cool to see the diversity and that it was a clone. It was many, if you go back to that 1881 New York Times, mm-hmm. many of those brewers are Jewish American brewers. And that's a really cool part of our history that I was completely unaware of, but it died obviously there. So I would say between the two, the concept, feasibility, development, were fairly similar between the two nations, with the exception of during that time that there was less adjunct used during up until the First World War. But then, in terms of implementation, it was snuffed out in Germany in 1906. It died. It was terminated. Whereas in the United States, at least for those last decades after 1906, it continued to thrive. And it became very quickly the beer of the world. Canada, for example, when we shut down our industry, you see these ads in Western Canadian newspapers, American rice beer, American rice beer. all across the nation. And a beer style that had been belittled in the press in Canada in the late 1800s, 1900s, became Canada's beer. They may not like hearing that, my countrymen, but same thing in Mexico, same thing in South Africa. Well,
the world's beer, really. Yeah.
Yeah, the world's beer. That's why that image there. It became, and that's why anywhere you go, I got a picture in the first law of my wife's frozen hand on a Idra, an island in November in Greece, and it was ice cold the beer, but it was a cold day. Her hand's really cold, but that glass of Mythos Lager beer is, you know, ice cold. That's us. I mean, they didn't drink beer like that back then. All this. You know, when I read a craft brewer say America has no brewing heritage, history, or traditions of our own, and in some cases we're only just now creating it, I'm like, oh no, there was a first revolution that's influencing the world. Your revolution is influencing it the same way in that first half century compared to what they did. It's just that we don't celebrate, acknowledge, or even understand it happened.
Interesting. Well, Greg, really appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you so much again for being here.
Yeah, thanks very much. Appreciate the opportunity. Thanks, Brad.
Today, my guest was Dr. Greg Casey, former president of the ASBC and author of the upcoming 5-volume set on American adjunct lagers. Thanks again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
A big thank you to Dr. Greg Casey for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the American Homebrewers Association. The Homebrewers Association invites you to choose your own brew venture. Join for 1 year and select a free brewing book from more than 60 titles to match your fermentation goals. Visit homebrewersassociation.org/beersmith to join the Homebrewers Association and treat yourself to a new brewing book. And Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith software. Beersmith for the Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with the same full suite of recipe building tools as our desktop version. Try Beersmith for the Web by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to click that like and subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're on. Clicking these buttons is a great way to support the show. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.